Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering local connections to groundbreaking innovations in the field of brain cancer research.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Another first-of-its-kind innovation from Kingston Health Sciences Center and Queen's University. A new 3D-printed surgical biopsy tool is changing the way scientists approach glioblastoma, a uniquely difficult-to-study and aggressive form of brain cancer. Neurosurgeon scientists and assistant professors Dr. James Persner and Dr. Teresa Persner, along with Queen's Engineering PhD candidate Caitlin Andrews, designed and patented a 3D surgical biopsy capsule, a tool used to take small tissue samples from brain tumors with precision. Published recently in the journal Operative Neurosurgery, this breakthrough has the potential to transform how brain tumors are studied and treated. Potential applications include more targeted radiation treatments, more precise and safer surgical decision-making, and new drug development informed by the most comprehensive molecular profiles of glioblastoma to date. Dr. Teresa Persner and engineering PhD candidate Caitlin Andrews sat down to share more about the development of this innovative tool.
Well, to get started, glioblastoma, it's incredibly complex. I was wondering if you could describe what makes this cancer so uniquely difficult to study.
Yeah, it's a really, of all the cancers that I've tried to study, including pediatric and adult brain cancers, for me, it's by quite a margin the most difficult one to tackle, to even conceive of how we start tackling, let alone to tackle. And there's a few reasons for that. So first of all, it's really heterogeneous. So it's made up of many different types of populations of cells. And unfortunately, we've shown that those different types of cells can actually convert between each other. And so you can think you're trying to create it, you're trying to find a target that you target with a drug. If that target can change at any time in response to your drug, it makes it very difficult. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that it's already all over the brain at the time of diagnosis. So if you look at an MRI, you see this round, bright circle, which is the tumor. But we know that back, you know, a long time ago, in the early days of neurosurgery, they actually took out the entire half of the brain that had the tumor in it. And it still came back on the other side of the brain. So it means that it's disseminated at diagnosis. And while, you know, there's this protective barrier in the brain called the blood-brain barrier that stops drugs and, you know, and toxins and bad things from getting into the brain. So it's good for your brain health. But when you're trying to get drugs into the brain, it prevents it from getting there. So where that big primary tumor is, that barrier is broken down. But for the rest of the brain, it's still very much intact. And so those are sort of the three reasons why this is just an incredibly difficult cancer to fight.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps this will be more for Caitlin, but I was wondering if you could explain in simple terms what this new 3D printed biopsy capsule is and what kind of impact it's going to have on research and treatment.
Absolutely. So as you said, it's a small 3D printed capsule. And the way it kind of works is that it adapts to the tip of pre-existing surgical suction. And then there's a little piston on the inside. And so when the suction's applied, the piston gets pulled up and that traps a sample of brain in the capsule itself. We can actually correlate our sample locations to the preoperative scans through intraoperative neuronavigation. So we can mark each point where the samples are taken from, and it's fully self-contained. So there's no cross-contamination between the samples at all. There's no risk of it damaging. It holds the integrity of the sample together. And that allows us to have like a very clear picture of that exact precise sample location going forward for research, which anyone who does genomics or transcriptomics research understands is very important. The more information we have and the less risk of contamination, the better our sample quality. And so all these factors together really let us have a very precise view of the different regions of the tumors that we're interested in, which is something that we haven't been able to really do easily with standard technologies. It could be done in not the safest ways, which obviously patient priority is our safety, or is our priority. Patient safety is our priority. But so it allows us to safely capture all these samples in a quick and efficient way that's not too much of a stress for the surgical team. So always the goal is shortest operation possible with as little risk to the patient as possible.
Mm-hmm. And are you guys already using this in your research right now?
Yeah, so we've used it in 2 patients so far. In our publication, we had a clinical validation where we used it versus the standard of care in a human glioblastoma tumor. And we've since also used it for other cases, and we're hoping to expand its use through the next year.
Mm-hmm. And I know the process of getting something patented is quite a journey. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that, how it all kind of began and how your team ended up here where you're now using this in research.
Yeah, I think it is. So device development can be a really long and arduous journey, especially getting it from concept to human. And so we were just very thoughtful from the very beginning on how we developed it, so that we developed it in a way that would ultimately be safe for human use, and acceptable from an ethics perspective. So from the very beginning, when we were designing the capsule itself, we took into account things like, you know, are these FDA approved materials? Are we creating it in a way that is very simple and easy to use with humans? And then when it came to IP, you know, what is the IP landscape? Are there devices out there that are very similar to ours that would preclude us from eventually filing a patent? And so from the very initial design steps, we took into account the eventual commercialization and the human readiness of the materials we were using. And so we got to human use very, very quickly, I think, because the end goal was embedded in the very initial design process.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think it means for Kingston Health Sciences Center and Queens to kind of be at the center of this global first innovation?
I think it's great. Yeah. I think Kingston's a small town in a lot of regards, right? And so Queens kind of, you know, it punches above its weight with Queens. And so whenever we can sort of raise a flag and say, hey, we're doing something innovative and novel, it just puts us on the global stage. Yeah. And so I think it's great. And I think that the more innovation we can do, the more, you know, kind of first that we can do, it also creates greater confidence in the patient population that they're going somewhere that has all the technology and all the resources and expertise required to receive, you know, exceptional care. And for me, at the end of the day, I love science. It's, you know, it's one of my favorite parts of my whole job is doing science. But I'm here for the patients, right? And to build that confidence in them and to see their confidence in us in our program from a clinical perspective, but also an innovation perspective, it's very gratifying.
Yeah. And I'm curious, Caitlin, since you're still a student, how does it feel to, you know, have this tool that you worked on being out there?
Yeah, it's definitely been a really interesting experience to be a part of. The tool development all started during my undergrad. I've been at Queens for far too long now. And getting to see it move through the stages, like, at the speed that it did, to now having used in patients, it's really been an amazing experience, to be honest. And it's an amazing team to have worked with, everyone from Jamie and Teresa, who are obviously like the spearheads of campaigning for it and helping with its development and providing all the user feedback, to even the other neurosurgeons. So in the early stages, when we were doing preclinical validation, we had the neurosurgery team here compare, as well as grad students, between the standard of care tools and our novel tool using porcine brain as our model. And so getting everybody's actual feedback from not just Jamie and Teresa, but the actual, like, every member of the neurosurgery team here, is a really unique opportunity. So it's been super interesting to be a part of, and I'm super grateful for the opportunity to have taken part in it.
And moving forward, you're building those partnerships with other hospitals, hoping to get this tool out there. What are your hopes for the next few years in this department?
I mean, so the tool was developed to do science, right? We didn't develop the tool because we just wanted a tool. We wanted a tool so that we could access tissue in a way and with a granularity and precision that wasn't otherwise possible. And so now the next 5 years, part of it will be, you know, if other people want the tool, more than happy to share it. We create it in a way where it's 30 cents a capsule. And we can literally send off an email to another institution. They can print it off. And we actually did that. We tried it with sick kids, and they printed off some of our capsules, right? So it's extremely mobile. We'd be delighted to share it with anyone. But what I'm really excited about is now the science that will come out of it. So it's kind of a little bit TBD. We'll see what happens. But that it was built to do science, not just to be a tool in itself.
Once again, that was neurosurgeon scientist Dr. Teresa Persner and Queen's Engineering PhD candidate Caitlin Andrews on a new 3D-printed surgical biopsy tool changing the way scientists approach glioblastoma. As Persner and Andrews mentioned, the capsule is already being used in operating rooms at KHSC, making Kingston the only medical center in the world currently using this new tool. As for what comes next, the Kingston team is now building partnerships with other hospitals across Ontario to expand its reach. Work is also underway to build a state-of-the-art tissue bank facility that can store samples from patients across Canada, positioning Kingston as a global hub for brain tumor research. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about a possible bag tag reduction in the town of Greater Napanee.
Thank you, Jesse. In a statement released Wednesday, November 26th, the town of Greater Napanee announced that next year's budget will include a recommendation to reduce the town's special levy for waste collection by approximately $50. The proposed change reflects savings expected from provincial legislation, which shifts responsibility for recycling from municipalities to producers beginning in January 2026. According to the town, the removal of municipal responsibility for recycling is expected to save roughly $450,000 in 2026. This proposed reduction stems from a budget directive issued by Mayor Terry Richardson under the provincial government's strong mayor powers, which require the mayor to set budget priorities. His directive calls for any savings from changes to the waste collection system to be returned directly to ratepayers rather than being placed in reserves or used elsewhere. The announcement followed a tense debate at the most recent council meeting on Tuesday, November 25th, at which staff presented a report on the town's waste management contract and 2026 funding model. Staff asked council to approve an amended agreement with Waste Management of Canada Corporation that was reviewed earlier in closed session. First introduced as a paper bag system to encourage waste reduction, the program was replaced in 2024 when the council decided to issue 50 tags per household and add a $200 charge to property tax bills. Despite significant public opposition, the policy continued into 2025. For 2026, Christy Kelly, Director of Environmental Services, said the process would remain the same. Households will receive 50 bag tags in January, and the levy will appear on the final tax installment. The cost change reflects the fact that the municipality will no longer handle curbside recycling. Kelly explained that the amended waste management contract is required because the company will no longer collect recycling. Although recycling costs will be eliminated, she noted that garbage collection rates are now locked in through 2029 to provide predictable budgeting. She said staff therefore recommend passing the savings directly to residents by reducing the levy to $150. Councillor Bob Norrie was the first to object. While he supported amending the waste management contract, he firmly opposed voting on anything that could affect the 2026 budget before seeing the full document. Chief Administrative Officer Matthew Grant attempted to clarify, telling council the vote was only to determine whether the proposal should proceed to budget deliberations. Councillor Mike Shanks said he was uncomfortable approving contract changes and forwarding a levy reduction recommendation before reviewing the draft 2026 budget. He pointed to numbers in the staff report suggesting that a $50 reduction could yield roughly $306,000 in savings and said he wanted a clearer understanding of the calculations. Grant noted that new provincial legislation requires municipalities to present and pass their budgets within 30 days, a shorter timeline than in previous years. Staff wanted council to have time to understand major items, he said, before entering the compressed window. The motion passed and the contract will be amended. The $150 figure will come before council for further discussion during budget meetings in January 2026. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the results of an SIU investigation into a mental health call involving the Gananoque Police.
The province's police watchdog has concluded that Gananoque Police Service officers did not commit any criminal offense during a confrontation with a man in crisis in August. According to the Special Investigations Unit, or SIU, Officers were dispatched to a local residence on the afternoon of August 15th after receiving a report of a disturbance. When they arrived, officers saw a 42-year-old man through a broken front window and attempted to calm him. The SIU said the man appeared to be in a mental health crisis and told officers that they would, quote, have to kill him, and displayed a knife. Gananoque police requested assistance from the Ontario Provincial Police as negotiations continued unsuccessfully. As the situation escalated, officers decided to enter the home. When the door was forced open, two officers fired their anti-riot weapon Enfields, or Arwins for short, striking the man. Another officer deployed a police dog, which bit the man on the right leg. The man was taken to hospital, where he was treated for bruising from the Arwin rounds and a minor dog bite that did not require stitches. After reviewing the evidence, SIU Director Joseph Martino found no reasonable grounds to believe any officer committed a criminal offense in the incident.
And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that report. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio with a story about a Habitat for Humanity proposal to build new affordable housing units in Bath.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Habitat for Humanity has proposed building two four-dwelling units in Bath by 2030. The units would be affordably priced through an affordable mortgage structure with the organization. According to their report, the organization's preliminary cost estimate, excluding the land, would be $1.4 million per fourplex. Funding is to come from government grants, land asset contributions, revenue from the organization's ReStore location in Kingston, donations, and fundraising events. Mortgage payments are set at 25% of the household's gross income, and families are not required to make a down payment. As part of the agreement, Habitat for Humanity retains a portion of the home's equity, and upon resale, both the homeowner and organization share in any market appreciation. Homeowners would also have to contribute 500 hours of volunteer work. If plans move forward, the company would be asking Loyalist Township for rezoning and site plan approvals, as well as exemptions for building permit fees, development charges, and impost fees. Construction of roads and services to the property line would need to take place, along with land transfers as well. The company noted these builds often involve community volunteers and student programs. These partnerships help reduce construction costs and provide training opportunities. CEO of Habitat for Humanity for the Kingston and Limestone area, Gary Lees, explained the timeline and what the company is looking to contribute.
Subject to municipal terms and conditions of land transfer, timelines to build, permits, etc., one fourplex in 2027. We've built this before. We feel confident we can pull the build off. It's so nice to build something that we've already built. It just makes life a little bit easier. So we could pull that off in 2027. I'm confident of that. And a second fourplex we would do in 2028, 2030. We'd want to work with needs a little bit as well for permitting and some of those things. Site servicing, of course, is important. Connection to municipal water and sanitary and sewer services, off-site stormwater management. All of those things need to get in place, of course, but we'll hustle and do our part with build. We will enlist volunteers to help us with the project, try to keep the costs down.
Lees spoke about the need for affordable housing.
Affordable mortgage structure, no down payment. It's a big stumbling block for folks out there is coming up with that down payment. When we're paying high rent and then we need to save so that we can put a down payment on a home, it's a daunting task, and Canadians are losing hope and vision of actual affordable home ownership. 80% of renters out there right now wish they owned their home, right? And that's a wish that's becoming very difficult. So the more equity that we can create in the home by keeping costs down, by donated product, using volunteers, anything that we can do to keep those costs down, we reinvest in building more affordable home ownership. And that's an investment in this country, this township, and our vicinity, our whole area. It's one I'm very proud of as well.
Lees spoke about the materials he has available now and the investment they'll be making in Loyalist Township.
I have containers of insulation right now. I have 400 sheets of drywall I need to get out of Home Depot's inventory. I've got stuff to build homes right here in Loyalist. And we just want to tap into that and keep the costs down so that when we sell the home to the family and then hold that mortgage at zero or a portion of the mortgage at zero, we can create as much equity as we can so we can reinvest in Loyalist and keep this ball rolling with affordable home ownership.
Lee speaks about the Restore location in Kingston and a new one opening in Napanee.
So our Restores are social entity that generate revenue, and we pump that revenue back into our home build programs. We are opening a second Restore in Napanee that opens on January 1. We'll soft open on January 1 as well. So we're going to bookend Loyalist and have you'll know where to go for your product either in Kingston or Napanee.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about the Vital Signs event in Prince Edward County.
The 2025 Vital Signs report for Prince Edward County was revealed last week with some eye-opening statistics. Vital Signs coordinator Anne Van Vlack presented the recent data at a presentation in Picton, where community leaders, municipal staff, and volunteers attended to hear numbers that will shape the future of the county for health services, education, transportation, housing, and employment. Not surprising was the fact that the county has a large population of seniors, many retiring from large urban centers. But what was surprising is the data showing the exit of young people and families. There had been a quick influx of young families during the pandemic, but some are leaving and so depleting the workforce. An open discussion helped reveal reasons for the exits and what the ripple effect might cause for services, schools, health, and recreation. High on the list were career opportunities, availability of higher education, transportation, and housing. The audience broke into discussion groups to brainstorm ideas based on the data that might help shape the future of Prince Edward County. Anne Van Vlack talks about Vital Signs and what is needed.
Anne, how long has Vital Signs been in existence?
In Prince Edward County, Vital Signs has been in existence since 2013. That was our first report that was published. The County Foundation itself had started in 2008 locally, but we're part of 208 foundations across Canada. Many of them do vital signs reports and have been doing them much longer.
And what is the purpose of vital signs?
The purpose of vital signs, it's Canada's largest community-driven data collection for community well-being. So it's really taking a pulse of our community. It's not just data. I'm constantly, like you are, to a lot of community meetings and engagements and hearing it firsthand. But we collect well-being data on a lot of critical key points of health, population, community safety, food security, transportation, a lot of data in that realm. And we use that data. We don't just produce reports from it. We use it constantly with community organizations. I get requests every week from community organizations to dig a little deeper in certain parts of data. And it's helpful for informed decision-making, grant applications, and advocacy.
Right. And what was the purpose for today?
Today was really meant, it's a starting point looking at the next community safety and well-being plan. We'll be starting to work on that next year. And it was meant to be a bit of an eye-opener because it showed new data looking at our population and demographic changes over time and the ripple effects of those changes, and that some of those patterns might reemerge. And if we can plan better for it, we're probably, the health of our community will be better if we can do some forward planning and be proactive.
And it helps the municipality and the council make decisions.
It does. It's really important that audience hears this message.
What would you like the public to know?
Really would like the public to know it's critically important that we continue to welcome newcomers to our community. If we don't have new residents moving in, and particularly young families, we're not sustaining our population. We are starting now to see our numbers decrease again, especially in the younger age groups. for those who've been here longer, they might remember that we have had a lot of school closures and lots of programs for youth and so on with our declining population. We also have a chance of losing other services. We came close to losing our local hospital a few years ago, and that was partly because of our declining population in our community. So we really, really have to find ways to remove barriers to people moving here, to workers coming here, and especially for young families. We really need the youth to help fill those classrooms and being the next, the next people in our population.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the sentencing of former teacher Kellyanne Jennings.
Kellyanne Jennings, a former Port Hope Elementary School teacher, is now behind bars after being sentenced for sex crimes against children. Justice Nathan Baker in a Lindsay court Thursday sentenced her to 4 years in prison, the sentencing request from Crown Attorney Julianne Barrett. Defense Attorney Dean Embry was advocating for a conditional sentence, sparing her any jail time. Jennings previously pleaded guilty to luring a minor through telecommunications and child pornography. She communicated with three former students through Snapchat. Jennings sent half-nude and full-nude photos of herself, as well as videos of her touching herself, including masturbation, to the victims. She requested that the victims, too, send her naked photos and videos as well. The victims did send photos and videos. The third victim forwarded the Snapchat material to Port Hope police, who opened an investigation and eventually arrested her in August 2024. Investigators alleged at that time that a boy came forward accusing her of inappropriate touching on a school trip. The incidents are alleged to have occurred between June 2022 and April 2024, all taking place in the Port Hope area. Justice Baker stated that a custodial sentence reflected the severity of the crimes committed and the ongoing harm to the children victims. He said children are vulnerable and deserve protection and respect and should not be used by adults for sexual gratification. There is a publication ban in effect to protect the identities of the victims. Embry denied interviewing or issuing a statement when court concluded. Jennings showed no emotion or remorse as she was taken into custody to begin serving her sentence. She will be placed on the sex offender registry for life following a period of probation. She is also prohibited from attending public parks, swimming pools, daycares, or any setting where children under the age of 16 are expected to be present, and she is barred from gaining employment where she has authority over children under the age of 16. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, December 4th, daytime high of -1, but a bone-chilling low of -12. It's going to be sunny, but it is going to be very cold with high wind chill. Friday, December 5th, daytime high of -5 with a 60% chance of snow throughout the day. Going to feel like -11 with the wind chill. Saturday, December 6th, daytime high of -2, overnight low of -10 with periods of snow throughout the day. Sunday, December 7th, daytime high of -3, feeling closer to zero, so a little warmer than the days before it. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, December 8th, a mix of sleet and freezing rain on the morning of December 8th, high of -4, low of -7, so it's going to be chilly and there is going to be precipitation. Might be worthwhile doing a school bus watch. Keep your eye on the tri-board for any announcements of bus cancellations.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.